And welcome to Law for Community Workers on the Go. This is a series of podcasts brought to you by Legal Aid New South Wales. In each episode, one of us from the Community Legal Education branch will be chatting to experts on different legal topics. We're really excited to have you all listening today, and we hope that you'll learn something new and interesting.
Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we are broadcasting from today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Welcome to our podcast. My name is Natalie. I'm from the Community Legal Education branch here at Legal Aid New South Wales, and I'm here today with two guests, with Jasmine and Kerry, who are from the Sexual Assault Communications Privilege branch here at Legal Aid New South Wales. And the topic we're going to be talking about today is, yes, at first it will be around subpoenas. So we know that a lot of community workers get issued with subpoenas from courts, and this can be quite a intimidating thing to get because it's from a court. And we'll talk first about responding to subpoenas generally, and then drill down specifically into what that sexual assault communications privilege is. And as with all our Law for Community Worker programs, the purpose of this is for community workers, social workers, health workers and others to be able to identify issues. So know that when they get a subpoena, now I know better how to respond to that. So it's about being those sort of problem spotters, and it's all about how we can best help our clients and the vulnerable people we work with. So I'll just start today by saying hi to Kerry and Jasmine and getting you both to, I guess, introduce yourselves and explain why you love the work you do.
Thanks, Natalie. So my name's Jasmine and I'm the solicitor with the Sexual Assault Communications Privilege Service. That's quite a mouthful, so we shorten it to SACIPS.
So the SACIPS service. That's what we'll be using today?
Yes, SACIPS. Okay. So something that I love about the work that we do is that we're improving the criminal justice system for sexual assault victims. And we're doing that by making sure that the trial process isn't unnecessarily upsetting or embarrassing for victims. And the way that we do this is by making sure that irrelevant counselling information is off limits in a criminal trial. And we do that by making sure that there is a lawyer for victims in the trial to put forward the victim's view about whether or not they want their counselling used in the trial or not used in the trial. And we can also provide advice for counsellors about how they can get help for their client and also about responding to subpoenas. So from our client's perspective, I think this makes a huge difference to their willingness to participate in prosecutions. And surely there's a community interest in making sure that these prosecutions go ahead.
Great, and we'll expand on all those things you were talking about, the counselling records and the types of trials, all that later on. Excellent. Thanks. Jasmine.
Yeah, my name's Kerry. I'm the paralegal in the SACIPS unit. Look, honestly, I really just agree with Jasmine. The work we do is really important. We also do a lot of work around advocating for change in the system, and we make submissions on policy, and all of that's really important in changing the way these sorts of systems work.
Thanks, Kerry. So before we go into the more details around the SACIPS service, Kerry, we might start by talking a bit about subpoenas generally. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, we know that it can be quite daunting for service providers to get a subpoena at their office. So can you explain first what is a subpoena and what are some of your top tips on how to respond?
Well, no, I agree. A subpoena can be very intimidating. Look, a subpoena is a court order. Essentially, it's a way for a court to be able to force someone who isn't part of a case normally to provide evidence to the court that might have something to do with the case. Sometimes it's documents or records that they want sent to the court. Other times someone might be called to come to the court and give evidence, which means they have to be cross-examined, asked questions by the lawyers. So usually if you're a community worker, most of the time they'll be asking for your documents or records for something that might have happened recently or a long time ago. So on a subpoena, it's issued by the court, so it'll have the court seal on it. There'll be a couple of important dates, the date it has to be sent to you by and the date you have to respond by. The most important thing is the schedule, and that's exactly what the subpoena is asking you for.
And the subpoenas that you see most are in criminal trials, so somebody has been charged with a sexual assault, for example, and their defence team, their defence lawyers and barristers are asking for usually, the victim's records.
That's usually the case. Sometimes it's a witness, but most of the time it would be the complainant in a sexual assault trial. So, yeah, but when you get a subpoena, read it carefully. It is in legalese, but the important things on it are fairly clear. It's the dates, exactly what's being asked for, and exactly what you need to do, which will be either go to or send documents to the court. Even though they often come with a letter from the lawyer who issued it, you have to send the documents to the court, not to the lawyer. That's really important to remember. If you've only got any questions about a subpoena or any legal document, it's really best to seek legal advice if you're confused about it.
Yeah, so I guess the important message is there not to ignore it, so you must...
No, you can't ignore a subpoena. Yeah. It's very important. Penalties for ignoring a subpoena can include imprisonment. Gosh. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
And it doesn't... But on the other hand, and I think this is what we'll be talking about later on, it doesn't also mean that you must send off all the records that have been requested.
No, the important thing is not to ignore it.
Yeah. And you can respond by... not necessarily sending all the documents, but that's what we're talking
absolutely.
About later, right?
Yeah. And we will get onto that in the context of SACCIRP.
Yeah.
Responding to a subpoena might actually mean sending a very short letter acknowledging that you've received the subpoena but saying that you won't be sending your documents because it's an invalid subpoena.
Great.
So don't ignore it, but on the other hand, don't just send your entire file.
Mm.
Perfect. And where can people go if they want more help or advice in responding to subpoenas? You mentioned they should get legal advice. So counsellors or community workers, where can they get that kind of advice?
Well, it depends. If you're in an organisation, it's possible you have your own legal section who might be able to give you advice. If they can't assist you with this, or you have a very short timeframes, or you don't have a legal section you can rely on, we do give advice to community workers and we do give advice to organisations. You can telephone us. We have a hotline. It's 9219588. We're happy to have a chat with you. And we also have an email address, which is SACCIPS, SACPS, at legalaid.nsw.gov.au.
So, and if you didn't catch those numbers, we will say them again. And they're also going to be on the podcast information.
Good. Yeah. We also produce a booklet, which is called The Subpoena Survival Guide. That's available for download from the Legal Aid website. It's also available if you need a hard copy from the Legal Aid publications. If you order one from them, they'll send you one.
Yeah, that's great. That's a really comprehensive booklet and it's free.
Yes, that's free.
Excellent. So the area that we're focusing on today is this sexual assault communication privilege, or SACCIPS. It's not a new area of law, Jasmine, but it might be an area that not a lot of people know about. So can you please explain what exactly is the sexual assault communications privilege and why it's important for community workers to know about?
Certainly. I think you're spot on there, Nat. It's been, Natalie, sorry,
yeah,
it's been around. this law has been around for 20 years, but notwithstanding that, it's still an area that people do struggle with. And so that's one of the reasons why we're very happy to be here today talking about the privilege and spreading the word. So the P in SACCIRP, Sexual Assault Communications Privilege, the P talks about how we go about protecting these counselling notes. So in any criminal or AVO matters that are before the court, there's a legal privilege that generally prevents counselling information from being used. So the best way to think about a privilege is that it's a shield that protects particular sorts of information. So when a defence lawyer sends out a subpoena, there's the schedule to the subpoena, and even though some of the notes that a community worker might fall within that schedule, the privilege acts as a shield to say we're not sending those notes to the court because they're protected by this particular law. And so what that means is that the court can't force you to reveal that privileged information unless there's a very good reason. So there's other types of privileges that people might be aware of. One example is a journalist's right to keep their sources confidential. people might be familiar with that. And there's also the privilege against self-incrimination. That's something that people are generally aware of as well, particularly from watching American court dramas. Yeah, so that's what a privilege is, essentially. So honing in now on the sexual assault communications privilege, if someone wants to use the victim's counselling information in court, they have to convince the court that the information is extremely relevant to the case. The legislation uses the term
substantial
probative value. Yeah, so it has to be really important to the issues of the case, and it has to be unavailable from any other source. So that's about protecting the relationship that the victim has with their counsellor. Another important aspect about the privilege is that the victim can consent at any point. So that's quite empowering, I think, for the victim, if they can have a look at what's in their counselling notes and make that decision. Because in a criminal trial, there's so much that's outside of the victim's control. They're just there as a witness for the prosecution. So it's nice that there is an area where they have a little bit of agency and control over whether they do or don't want their counselling information used in court. There's a few points to note about the privilege, and the devil's always in the detail. So this is the areas that people, I think, get a little bit confused about. The first thing is that the privilege protects counselling information for a person who has ever been a victim of a sexual assault. So that means that it doesn't necessarily need to be a sexual assault trial. Quite often it is, but it doesn't have to be. And it also means that the counselling, it could have been about another sexual assault. It doesn't necessarily need to be about the sexual assault that has to do with the trial. Another important point is the counselling doesn't need to be about the sexual assault. So if you think of a real life example, if you've got a person with very complex needs, sometimes it's difficult to work out what parts of the counselling are about their mental health, what parts of the counselling could be about possible drug and alcohol issues that they might have, or what counselling is about the effects of the sexual assault on their life. So we don't need to worry about that so much, just so long as it meets the definition of counselling, all of that information is protected. Another point, leading on from that last one, is that the term counselling is defined very broadly. So the legislation doesn't get bogged down in questions about whether or not someone has a particular qualification. It's all about whether or not someone has training, study, or experience relevant to the process of counselling. So it also quite specifically points out in the legislation that you might be doing it as a volunteer. It doesn't need to be paid employment. That definition of counsellor is extremely broad. Another practical thing that I think deserves a little bit of attention is that the counselling information isn't just about the counsellor's file. Quite often, as Kerry said before, it is about the file, because particularly if you're talking about an historical sexual assault, the counsellor won't have any independent recollection of what they spoke about in counselling, so they'll be relying on the file. But the thing that's protected is the information. So it can be the counsellor's file, or it could be the counsellor being called to give evidence in the witness box about what they learnt about the person from that counselling process. So it's very broad.
And the policy reason behind this legislation is to allow people who've experienced sexual assault or trauma to go and be able to freely talk to a counsellor without thinking that that might become known to the defendant in court. Mm.
For counselling to be effective, people really do need to be able to speak openly and freely. Before this privilege was introduced, we anecdotally heard things about counsellors not keeping notes, and obviously that's going to have an impact on the quality of counselling that they provide people, and it's also going to impact on the victim, because each time they get counselling, they might need to repeat their story, and that's quite re-traumatising for that person. So, yes, you're spot on there. People need to be able to trust that there is that privacy in the counselling relationship. Another very important reason why we have this privilege from a legal perspective is that counselling is not investigative, it's therapeutic. So the reason that counsellors are asking clients about what happened to them isn't because they're conducting some kind of an investigation to get to the bottom of what happened. They really only need to hear about a little bit of it so that they can get on with their therapeutic role of counselling the person. And from a legal perspective as well, any of the information that the counsellor has is what we call in legalese hearsay. So basically, the information that the counsellor has, they don't have any personal knowledge of what's happened. They're basically relying on what their client has told them. So if you think about the relevance of that to a legal trial, it's not too relevant.
So Jasmine, can you tell me about, I guess, how the law works in practice, or an example of how you've seen it really make a difference in someone's life?
Yes, certainly. I can think of an example from quite early on in my time in this role. It was a historical sexual assault matter. So my client had been abused in an institutional setting by someone who was in authority, and it had happened over 20 years ago. And he was one of a number of victims. I think there was at least over 15 victims. So he was one of a number of victims.
The type of thing we were seeing in the Royal Commission.
Yes, exactly. So he received a phone call from the DPP solicitor. I think it was about a month out from the trial. And it was letting him know that his counselling records had been subpoenaed. And how did he feel when he heard about this? He was physically sick. It was huge.
As an adult, he'd gone to a counsellor.
He had a very good relationship with his counsellor. I think he'd been seeing his counsellor for at least 5 years as an adult, and he felt as though that was a safe place where he could talk to someone about the effects of the abuse on him. It really threw him, the fact that this private information was being subpoenaed by the defendant. And I guess also, if you think about a situation like that, that's really private personal information, and it would have been so traumatizing for him to think that the person who abused him was potentially going to have access to his innermost thoughts. So
he was able to access legal help?
Yes. So we were able to provide a lawyer for him in court. Another thing that we were able to do was put together a confidential affidavit. So that's an affidavit that would have been read just by the judge to explain to the judge the impact that having these notes coming out would have on the client. Interestingly, having gone through the notes, and the only people that had access to the notes was the judge, the client, and I, so we read through the notes, and the vast bulk of the counselling had nothing to do with the facts of what happened. There were a few small points in the notes that did touch on the factual scenarios of what happened, and ironically, they backed up his version of events, so they wouldn't have been helpful for the defence at all. So my client had the choice of whether or not to consent to those notes going forward. He chose not to consent for the reasons I was outlining before. He just wanted to kind of keep his counselling well away from the trial and just kind of get the trial over and done with. So what happened, we were at court, we were able to represent him, we explained to the judge why our client wasn't consenting. The judge was able to kind of let the defendant know that there was nothing to see here, and the defendant didn't press the issue. So his counselling remained private. The trial ran. It would have been very tough for him to give evidence, notwithstanding that his counselling was kept private. But then I understand afterwards, this is a point that we weren't involved, but I understand that the defendant was convicted and is now serving a lengthy sentence.
Great. Thanks, Jasmine, for that oversight of the suck-ups. We might go now, sort of start to wrap up around some really practical tips for community workers, for people listening, on how they can protect their clients' records and privacy.
So I think the first thing is having a system so that counsellors can identify sensitive counselling records within their organisation. I think that's very important because you need to know what it is that you want to protect.
And they might not necessarily know if there has been a sexual assault in the past or anything.
Yeah,
so this is general information tips around there.
That's actually a really good point. Certainly we've found with large organisations, ones that have dedicated specialist sexual assault services, a lot of people in the organisation may not have any knowledge that these records might even be protected. So it can get quite complicated.
So a good thing would be to have a system where those records are kept separately and maybe some way of flagging them as some private and confidential. That would be a very good start. The second thing is, and I think this is something that Kerry talked about before, if you get served with a subpoena, get legal advice. So we totally accept that receiving a subpoena can be very intimidating. The fact that there are those very tight timeframes, quite often by the time it arrives on the counsellor's desk, they only have a number of days to respond. So if you need more time, ask for more time rather than doing a rush job. And it can also be very intimidating receiving that subpoena, noting that it does have something along the lines of, if you do not comply with this subpoena, you may be arrested. Yep. So that's very intimidating. And as we noted before, complying with a subpoena does not mean handing over your entire file. So you need to, and this is where the legal advice comes in. First of all, you need to make sure that the issuer of the subpoena has dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's and that it's a valid subpoena. And it also means, in terms of the sexual assault communications privilege, that permission has been granted by a judge to issue the subpoena.
So I think that was some really good, I guess, takeaway points, would you say, for community workers. So have a system for marking your records as private or confidential, so you know which ones might fall under that privilege. And tips on complying with a subpoena is basically get legal advice urgently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And just remember what Jasmine said earlier is counselling records, if someone can have the privilege, they don't have it on just those records, they have it on all of their counselling records.
Yes.
So it's a privilege that attaches to the information about a particular person, not just particular information about them, it's all of the counselling information about them.
Right. So it's really something for anyone, and like you said, it's not just someone with a qualification, it could be anyone, it could be a volunteer at a women's refuge or a really, really wide range of people who should have an awareness about this.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good example, Natalie, a volunteer at a women's refuge. Yeah. They might not consider themselves a counsellor. They might not have the job title of a counsellor, but certainly if you look at this legislation, any notes that they keep or information that they have through going through a counselling process with their client would be protected.
And sometimes we have people listening to the podcast who are from outside of New South Wales. This is just a New South Wales law. Is that right?
Well, this is a New South Wales law, but every state in Australia now has some version of it. And Queensland's just started recently, and they were the last ones on board. They're all a little bit different. When you have a request, the important thing to remember is if it's a request from a court, what matters is where the court is. So if you're in Melbourne or Brisbane and a subpoena from Sydney comes to you, then you use New South Wales law and vice versa. So if you're in New South Wales and you get a request from Melbourne or something like that, it'll be Victorian law. So you'll need to get advice about the law in the state the court is in. Where you are doesn't actually matter.
That's really
much.
Helpful. And I guess in cases of sexual assault matters, that could happen quite commonly.
It happens quite frequently.
Yeah.
So to finish off, because I think we need to wrap up now. Can you please, I guess, remind your audience about your service? So what does your service do for the community workers who are listening? How can you help? How can they contact
you? Certainly. There's two ways we can help. First of all, we can provide advice to counsellors, and we can also liaise with the lawyers on their behalf. We can also arrange for a lawyer to attend at court to represent their client, the victim of the matter. And the way that we can be contacted is probably best by email or phone. So our phone number is 9219-5888. And Natalie, I think you're going to have the email address on the podcast.
Yeah, we'll have all that info there.
And another important point is that our service isn't means tested. So in layman's terms, it's free.
Yep.
So you don't need to worry about the money.
So free for the counsellors who ring up for legal advice and free for the complainants in court.
That's right.
Yes, that's right.
Excellent. Thank you so much to Jasmine and Kerry. I think we learnt a lot. I learnt a lot about this service, and I think the community workers and others listening will have as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us here.
See you next time.
Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you. So, Kerry, if community workers listening want more information about this, can your service help with that?
Well, if you deal with these sorts of things on a regular basis, we also offer a training workshop. So either Jasmine or I will usually come out to your organisation and give you an explanation of it and go through all of it and answer questions. So we're happy to sort of come out and train people up on a bit more understanding of how this all works.
That's excellent. Thank you. And we'll give the email address to request that training in the podcast information.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you're enjoying Law for Community Workers on the Go, make sure to spread the word. And if you have any feedback or even topic suggestions, please get in touch with us via email. Our address is cle@legalaid.newsouthwales.gov.au. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, thanks again from the CLE branch here at Legal Aid New South Wales.